Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Friday on the program, a two-hour review of Rick Warren's best-selling book, The Purpose-Driven Life. Now, I will remind you, this is a different review than the one we did as a roundtable with Pastor Tom Baker and Dr. Larry Rast and Pastor Will Whedon some months back. This one, we have Pastor Tom Baker alongside again for another two-hour review of Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. No, I'm sorry, it's Friday on Issues Etc. Tomorrow is a different day. Friday on Issues Etc. For the first part of this last hour, we're going to be talking about two issues, an amendment to the Illinois Constitution that would ban same-sex marriage, and criticism from gay activists leveled at an appointment made by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. We're going to be talking about both of those issues with Peter LaBarbera, who is executive director of Illinois Family Institute based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. Peter, welcome back to Issues Etc.
No, thank you, Todd. Well, thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us about this apparently bipartisan approach to a constitutional amendment in Illinois.
Well, Todd, we're very excited. We found out about this about a week and a half ago. Two congressmen, assembly members, have put forth proposals. One would ban just recognition of so-called gay marriage. And, of course, Todd, I always say so-called because it will never be a marriage. Two men cannot marry each other. The other proposal by Bill Mitchell, who's a Republican, the first one was by William Grunlow, by the way, who's a Democrat. Mitchell's proposal would have a constitutional amendment which would not only ban recognition of so-called gay marriage, it would also propose that any relationship between persons of the same sex in a civil union or domestic partnership or similar type relationship would not be recognized in the state of Illinois.
And the proposal on the Democratic side?
The Democratic side would would only say that marriage is recognized as between a man and a woman. That's it.
So it wouldn't rule out what would be called civil unions.
Yes, and the reason we are I'm so in favor of the Mitchell approach. I know they're both good men, but the Mitchell approach would cover domestic partnerships, civil unions, and what we have seen happen in other states, for example, California. The citizens work hard, they pass an amendment to protect marriage, and then the politicians or the judges step in and they give the same rights, benefits, and responsibilities of marriage to homosexuals, just calling it a different name.
Where does Illinois law stand on this issue today?
Illinois law defines marriage as between a man and a woman. And so we don't think immediately they could rush in and say, let's say they got this full so-called marriage right in Massachusetts. They couldn't rush in and say, recognize our right in Illinois to marry. But what they would do is there would be lawsuits. There almost certainly will be lawsuits, Todd, and that's the reason why I think so many people now are saying, let's take it out of the hands of these activist judges and let's let the people decide. And I'm confident if we let the people decide on this issue, we'll win, and we will protect marriage.
So this is an effort on both sides, both of these proposals to one degree or another, is an effort to head off judicial activism, judges simply ruling by fiat from the bench that, as they did in Massachusetts, well, this is the way it's going to be.
Exactly, and it happened in Vermont before. If you will recall, Todd, Vermont, they didn't force them to accept marriage, but they forced the legislature. This is Governor Dean's home state, and he was part of this, by the way. They forced the legislature to approve these so-called civil unions, which essentially are just like marriage, only under a different name.
Now, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, there is recorded the reaction of Rick Garcia. We'll be talking a bit about him as well in the second part of our conversation. He's political director of Equality Illinois, an Illinois gay rights organization. He says of these amendments, they are nothing more than an attack on gay and lesbian citizens and their families. I frankly think that most legislators are decent folks and recognize this for what it is, election year politicking. How do you respond?
Well, I just think Rick's being a little arrogant. You know, people have the right to advance their own moral creed, and I think most people in the state of Illinois are opposed to the idea that two men or two women should be able to marry. Now, that's what his agenda is. But this is not just election year politics. And, you know, even if it were, Todd, it's something that's popular with the people. A lot of times these issues that are called, election year issues or when they're discussed in that way by sort of the elites in our society, the idea is that, oh, something's wrong with the fact that most people would be against the homosexual agenda. Well, the reason that these issues are trotted out in an election year is because they're popular, and I think if we can get this to the floor, and Mr. Garcia's lobby efforts fail, because they'll try to keep this bottled up in some committee, if we can get it out to the floor, we will get a vote on it, and hopefully we will win.
What are the chances, if you count heads, of actually getting a constitutional amendment here? And what would that involve beyond just, an approval by a legislative body?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's going to be God. It's going to be a God thing, Todd, definitely, because right now the assembly is not run by all pro-family representatives. However, we were able to defeat, the Illinois Family Institute had a role in this, but we all worked hard, all the pro-family groups. We defeated the sexual orientation bill last year. They never thought that would happen, and the way we defeated it was we worked with Southern senators in the southern half of the state, mostly Democrats, who were opposed to the idea of normalizing homosexuality and cross-dressing, because the bill actually contained a provision which would apply to transvestites. Believe it or not, Todd. So this one is more proactive, which is why I like it. We're not just playing defense. We're going on the offense. We're saying, no, we're not going to wait until some lawsuit forces Illinois to embrace homosexual civil unions. We're going to state right now that this is the policy of the people of the state. They want marriage to be between a man and a woman. It would have to pass by 3/5, I believe, Todd, in the General Assembly, and then it would come out for a popular vote in the state. The popular vote is not what I worry about. It's about being bottled up in the legislature.
How would you respond to someone who says that a bill or an amendment to ban same-sex marriage in Illinois is homophobia?
Well, you know, if you look at what homophobia is, the way it's described by homosexual activists, and I've monitored this issue for well over a decade, Todd, everything's homophobia. If you're opposed to homosexual behavior as wrong, you are a quote-unquote homophobe. And so what I tell Christians is just get used to sometimes you'll be called names, but the truth is we all have a right to live out our moral beliefs, and the real evil of homosexual sexual orientation laws and regulations and legislation is it forces people to sublimate their own morals to some artificial law. For example, if there were a gay rights law in the state of Illinois, teachers, you would have no way to stop, for example, a homosexual activist teacher in the classroom. And let's say you have a homosexual teacher who decides a man, he's going to put a picture of his gay lover on the desk of your child's classroom. Well, most parents would not be averse to that if it were a man and a woman. I think I would actually like my a male teacher to put a picture of his wife on the desk, but they don't think it's the same for homosexuals, putting the picture of the homosexual on the desk. So what the law would do is it would force unequal things to be treated as equal, and that's why these laws are dangerous, and they shouldn't really be called civil rights laws, because they're all about validating behavior, which for centuries and centuries has been wrong.
How do you, then finally on this issue, how do you respond to Rick Garcia again, where he's quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as saying, or asking, why do people care who you live with or who you marry? Who you love and who you live with are your business. I guess I would ask, why should anyone care?
Well, you know, I think Christians, Todd, they do care. I mean, we do care what people do behind closed doors, not that we're going to go bash in their closed doors, but we care about people. We don't want to celebrate behavior which God does not like. That's why Christians care. I think the rest of the state, the people, we should care, because this legislation, any effort to win homosexual so-called marriages in the state of Illinois, will have far-reaching impact well beyond the homosexual couples themselves. For example, I was talking about the classroom. If you have gay so-called marriage, there will be no basis upon which to quote-unquote discriminate in the classroom, which means you would have to teach homosexual marriage as normative to students. Also, homosexual adoption. If you had a gay marriage law, you would be forced to treat children, babies adopted by, say, two gay men would be treated the same as between a man and a woman, and nobody believes that is a very smart thing to do, Todd.
The second issue and the final issue that I wanted to talk to you about was the reaction, and this again comes from Rick Garcia, political director for Equality Illinois, his reaction in the paper to Governor Rod Blagojevich's recent decision to appoint former U.S. Representative Glenn Pushard to the Southern Illinois University Board of Trustees. What is Garcia's concern here?
Well, I think this, again, is this kind of this arrogance by these powerful homosexual groups. I read the story about Mr. Pushard, and actually by the end of the story there's another homosexual activist who says that she's talked with him and she's fine with him. And so, in other words, Mr. Pushard is actually pro-homosexual. So I think Rick Garcia was opposed to something Pushard said in an old run for governor, in which he basically affirmed the rights of people, for example, that could be forced under a gay rights law not to, say, rent a room in their house to a homosexual couple. Now, Todd, I think this is very important, the freedom of association. I think you should have the right, if I were shacking up with my girlfriend, I'm married, by the way, this is just hypothetical, you should have the right not to rent to an unmarried couple because you believe it's wrong. In the same sense, you should have the right not to rent to a homosexual couple if you really believe that homosexual behavior is wrong. It's your free right, and that's what Mr. Pushard was affirming, and Rick Garcia used that to attack him.
So, in essence, if Pushard's views are accurately represented here, the objections should not necessarily be coming from the pro-homosexual activists, but perhaps from organizations like yours.
Yeah, I think that we need to watch what he does down there, because the last quote in the story that I saw, I guess this is the Tribune, is a homosexual activist who says that Pushard is a man committed to equal treatment, and I think he will be a wonderful addition to the SIU board. So, again, you know, when I hear that word equal, I'm for equal rights. That's what equal rights really are, Todd, and I'm sure you are as well. But we have to warn Christians and everybody in the state, when homosexual activists talk about equal rights, they're really talking about treating unequal things, such as homosexual so-called marriage, with good things, regular marriage. And that's why these laws are so dangerous.
Peter LaBarbera, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc. Keep up the good work.
Sure, Todd. Can I give our website out?
I'll be doing that here in just a moment.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Peter LaBarbera is Executive Director of Illinois Family Institute, based in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. Their website address is illinoisfamily.org, all one word, illinoisfamily.org, and their phone number, area code 630-790-8370. That's 630-790-8370.
We're going to California and Texas and New York. We're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
That was Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean in a speech. I think it was a concession speech, if I'm not mistaken, Monday night following the Iowa caucuses, where by all accounts he came in third, a distant third, following two people who were not expected to win. Dean was the anointed, to win Iowa, and he didn't. It doesn't seem to have caused his enthusiasm to flag at all. We're going to be talking about the Democratic presidential race, the New Hampshire primary, which is less than a week away, Super Tuesday, which follows the next week after that, including a primary here in Missouri and a crucial state, Southern Carolina, for its own reasons, with Dr. Jeff Waltz. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Waltz, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Good to be back.
By the way, folks, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Your reaction, Dr. Waltz, to Dean's Monday night speech after coming in third at Iowa?
Yeah, a couple of reactions, Todd. On the one hand, it's refreshing to see a politician who is comfortable with himself, who is not afraid to be unconventional, who speaks a little bit off the cuff, who I guess is not as programmed as we're used to seeing. So I think on the one hand, that Monday night concession speech was refreshing in a sense, and clearly was designed, it seems to me, perhaps in retrospect, to really keep the Dean base, keep the hardcore supporters rallied and ready for New Hampshire. On the other hand, certainly not what the Dean campaign wants to be remembered for. It seemed to me that it's going to reinforce very viscerally a sense among some in the electorate and some in America that Dean perhaps doesn't have a certain demeanor or a certain temperament to be president. It showed someone who, you know, you have to ask yourself, could we trust this person, this man, with high-level decisions of an international basis? Is this someone that could negotiate for us, that someone that could stay in control? And, you know, in a sense, and a couple of observers have mentioned this, it reinforced some of our fears about him. And this may be unfair in a sense, but a few people, too, are saying, well, recall some of the impressions, at least, people had of Dan Quayle, for example, the VP, and his misspelling of potato back in the early 90s, for some people, unfortunately, that one situation or that one vignette really reinforced that impression of him. So, again, kind of a way to enthuse his own supporters for Dean, but on the other hand, I just can't imagine the Republicans, I'm sure, are thinking about how this could be used in an ad or two down the road if Dean does bounce back.
Moving down the line of the candidates here in a brief fashion, what happened to Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt in Iowa? He was expected to at least have a decent showing. He came in fourth.
Yeah, Gephardt. Yeah, very, very interesting and I think in some ways unfortunate development, since Gephardt does have tremendous experience in the political arena. He does have leadership experience. He has, I think, a wonderful health care proposal, at least in its vision or in its goal for America. A couple of things with Gephardt, it seems to me. One is the union vote and the union backing on which he was basing much of his campaign clearly is not what it used to be in American politics. It used to be if a Democratic candidate especially could shore up that union support, you had so many numbers and you had such political clout that if not carry the day, that would be just a key building block in a Democratic candidate's campaign. So the union vote, while it seemed to support Gephardt, was not as strong clearly as it's been in the past. Also, in looking at some of the exit polls that were conducted, a number of Democratic voters in Iowa in the caucuses were trying to find someone who could beat or who could challenge George W. Bush in the fall. Just looking at a couple of numbers here from a national election pool, it's kind of striking to see one question here. The question is, who or which candidate can beat George W. Bush? And looking at the different candidates, only 6% of the respondents felt that Gephardt was the person to beat Bush, whereas Kerry did much better in that category. And also looking at experience, while Gephardt did better actually in experience, perceived experience, than Edwards or Dean, John Kerry did even better than Gephardt. So, Gephardt, again, wasn't viewed perhaps as someone who could beat Bush or had the right tenor or credentials to challenge Bush come fall.
Did it also have something to do with the fact, at least I heard on the morning news shows as I watched them, an interview with Gephardt's campaign manager immediately prior to the Iowa caucuses? This might even been Monday morning, if I'm not mistaken. It was pointed out that after Iowa, if Gephardt didn't win, he was basically broke.
Yeah. He had put so much energy, he had put so much money into establishing a network, into establishing his Iowa organization, that he really needed to do well, if not win Iowa, to generate money. And it's striking, as you know, Todd, when you win, money follows you, and vice versa in some ways, to see the amount of money now that the Kerry and Edwards camps have raised even in the last few days is very impressive and significant. I'd say another possible problem Gephardt had in Iowa, Gephardt, it seemed to me, more than Edwards and Kerry, really went after Dean hard. And there was a suggestion that there was just too much negativity coming from Gephardt challenging Dean and then going the other way as well, with Dean taking on Gephardt, or at least responding to Gephardt in a sense. So that might have been a small part of it as well.
I want to get to Kerry eventually here, but let's talk about Edwards a bit. He was kind of came out of nowhere in Iowa, and certainly he was last among the four going in, even with the poll numbers trending in different directions in the days before Iowa, and yet he finished a very strong second.
Yeah. Edwards, the polling data shows, is seen as more of someone who's looking out for the common needs and understands better the common situations of men and women. So in a sense, he's kind of a blue-collar candidate, of course, a little younger candidate, arguably, fairly photogenic and has a certain charisma that perhaps a few of the others don't. So that, I think some of those factors helped him. And he also really tried and has tried to stay as positive as possible on the campaign. He hasn't, it seemed to me, gone after other Democrats like some of his, Democratic candidates have gone after others. So, and that more of a clean campaign may have helped him as well.
The fact that he had, I mean, I'm amazed by the contrast of Gephardt fourth, Edwards second. Gephardt had a unparalleled machine, perhaps second only to Dean's machine in Iowa, of organization. From all reports, Edwards had virtually no organization in Iowa and yet comes in second.
Yeah.
They say that it's money, it's a message, and it's a machine that gets you elected. But those don't seem to work in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right, Todd. They don't seem to work. And a couple other theories people have had, I haven't seen really good numbers on this, but it was a fairly cold night in Iowa. And if you look at the vote by age, or the caucus vote by age, you'll see, for example, that you would think Gephardt might do better in some ways, given his strong organization and his initial field work, given all the people he's had on the ground there. And he didn't do as well as people thought he might do with an older crowd in Iowa. So that was one, again, another possible liability that Gephardt was dealing with in Iowa.
With only a minute before we go to our bottom of the hour break, Dr. Waltz, still on the issue of Edwards coming a week from, actually about 2 weeks from now, a little bit less, a Super Tuesday, including South Carolina, the home state of Edwards. Does he have to win it? If he's still in the race at that point, does he have to win it to continue?
Yeah, he certainly has to win his home state. And given kind of the built-in expectations of some of those primaries on that date, he has to, if not win some of the other primaries, at least do well. As things move away from the South, as we have our Wisconsin primary coming up in a few weeks as well on the 17th, and as we move into New York and California and so on after that in early March, it might be more difficult for Edwards to parlay some of his momentum into those states. So he needs to firmly establish himself going into those larger and more populous states.
When we come back from this break, the unexpected and yet current frontrunner in the Democratic presidential race, John Kerry, he's headed toward New Hampshire. I just heard today someone say on the news, John Kerry was always the frontrunner. I don't know. He didn't have the money at that point, and he certainly did not have the poll numbers until very close to Iowa. We'll talk about John Kerry and his viability and whether or not in a race between he and George W. Bush, he has a chance. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you noticed in many churches today, the God you find is convenient and non-confrontational, a sugar-sweet pushover of a God? What's happening when God seems to be against you, when God seems to be your problem, when God seems to be your enemy? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is called When God Becomes My Enemy. Through this in-depth study of the Old Testament complaint psalms, you'll discover the truth about God in the darkest of times. To order When God Becomes My Enemy, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
A new species, weeding out the truth.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the editors and contributing writers to Creation Magazine. Ken, I take it that you're making a play on words here, so please do weed out the truth for us.
Okay, well, two British scientists have just reported their findings of a new species of a type of weed known as a groundsel. In reality, what they really found was a hybrid between two other groundsel species. Yet a commentary in the famous newspaper, The Times of London, proudly proclaimed this as a demonstration of evolution in action. Furthermore, in a stab at believers in biblical creation, the author stated that the weed's discovery confirms that Darwin was right and the creationists are wrong. But does the formation of a new species really conflict with Scripture? Not at all, as we've repeatedly shown. Rapid diversification within the created kinds of plants and animals, including speciation, is a specific prediction of the creation model. You see, following the global flood at the time of Noah, about 4,500 years ago, plants, animals, and people spread out into the new world. Adaptation to new habitats and niches would be expected. But the point is, groundsel still is groundsel. This is not evolution.
Using the Bible as our authority, would we ever predict that life might be in outer space? Ken Ham tackles that question in a free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Log on to AnswersRadio.com.
It's 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, partly cloudy overnight. We've got a chance for flurries, low near 20. For tomorrow, partly sunny and a high near 30. Right now in St. Louis, clear and it's 45. For the remaining 25 minutes of Issues Etc., Pastor Todd and guests will talk about the Democratic presidential race and take your phone calls on Issues Etc. straight ahead.
Despite abortion advocates' claims to the contrary, there are not too few abortion clinics, but the supply is greater than the demand. Now clinics are competing for clients.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
There has been a national decline in abortions from 1.6 to 1.4 million per year. And as the New York Times reports, the decline has forced abortion clinics to compete for clients, from price wars to enhanced spa-like clinics. It's grotesque that abortionists now treat abortion as a beauty product to drum up business. Going to a spa-like clinic doesn't change the fact that an innocent baby loses its life and a woman is exploited.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Jeff Waltz is our guest. We're talking about the presidential race, the Democratic presidential race, for that matter. Before we go on with our conversation, we have a new Issues Etc. book of the month for January. I say new because this is the second year running that we've done the book of the month. The book of the month is, we go through a long list of books published by Concordia Publishing House and the things that are available there, and we pick out the things best suited to you, to our listeners. And we know one of the great strengths of Issues Etc. is not only when we do stuff of a secular nature like this, but when we delve into theology and especially into interpretation of Scripture, the very heart of the Christian faith. That's what our latest Issues Etc. book of the month does, When God Becomes My Enemy, some of the most difficult scriptures to interpret, the Complaint Psalms. The book costs $20.99 plus shipping and handling, and it can be yours by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find information on the book right under the What's New section. Come into one of Concordia Publishing House's two locations in St. Louis at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis or here in Clayton on the campus of Concordia Seminary. Both of those locations are bookstores for Concordia Publishing House. Both of those locations will have our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, When God Becomes My Enemy. When you get the book, make sure you mention issues, etc. Now, if you've got a question or a comment on the Democratic presidential race, the candidates, the attrition, there were 9, and then there were 8, and then right before Iowa, Carol Mosley Braun dropped out, and then Dick Gephardt dropped out. A winnowing process, they say. If you've got a question on any of those candidates or on the process, call now 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Jeff Waltz is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Before we go on to talk about John Kerry, it strikes me that we are dealing with two different, very different processes in this primary season, the caucus and the primary. How would you describe those two things?
Good point here, Todd. Primary, just like voting in any kind of election where you go to a certain polling place, or in some states you can mail in your ballot and you actually cast a ballot. It's very quick, it's very simple, very individualistic, takes probably 5 or 10 minutes. So we're most familiar with the primary type of voting. Caucus is a very unique form, and Iowa actually really jumped into the caucus fray in a significant way back in 1972 with an early date. This is more like a series of town meetings, almost in Iowa, almost 2,000 of these meetings on the Democratic side, where you actually gather in schoolhouses, you gather in public buildings, in people's homes, and it's a 2-hour, 3-hour process, somewhere along those lines, where you actually have some discussions about the candidates. And then eventually, it's kind of, I guess, like being back in school, you go to a certain area of the house or the gymnasium or the library to indicate your support for a certain candidate. And then there are certain thresholds where a candidate needs, for example, 15% of the support of the people at that meeting, whether there be 14 people there or 18 people there or 115. And if you don't have that support, then you're instructed either to join another group that has that threshold or be or act as an uncommitted delegate. So the caucus, in many ways, is much more deliberative. It's an evening event. It's kind of the small town or small d democracy in its purest form.
It assumes as a process that the people who participate are going to go in largely willing to change their minds.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there is an expectation as you enter any of the caucuses that are offered and that are in your precinct area that you do keep an open mind, that you're willing to listen to arguments and willing to be flexible if persuasive arguments are made for another candidate. So it's much more about deliberation and trying to be persuasive and trying to get issues and points out on different candidates.
Do the candidates actually show up at the real deliberative moments there in these gymnasiums and things like that?
Not to my knowledge. That is possible, but not to my knowledge. It's generally something where it's just the folks in that caucus who've already had time to meet or to at least listen to some of these candidates, and then it's more, you know, more or less in the hands of the people.
Is Iowa being first really any indicator of anything?
Really a mixed record, Todd. We've seen where Iowa has been a harbinger of things to come or has, for example, been an indication of who might win down the road the nomination, although it's quite possible to finish second, third, or fourth and then to rebound like George Herbert Walker Bush did, rebound and then actually win the nomination. So it really is a mixed bag, and that's in part because you have a different process but also a very different demographic than you'll have in other states.
Several candidates did not even take a bite at the Iowan apple. I'm thinking about Joe Lieberman and Dennis Kucinich, who may have taken a little bit of a nibble, but Joe Lieberman was pretty clear. He said, I'm not even going to really make a stab at Iowa. Does that mean now that they are non-factors in the primary season for the Democrats?
I don't think non-factors. Part of Lieberman's problem or challenge was he got a bit of a late start, of course, because he wanted to see if Al Gore was going to run or not and deferred to him. And as we talked about before, it's so important in Iowa to have an organization on the ground literally years in advance. So you have folks like Kucinich and Lieberman and then Wesley Clark, of course, who came in late, who simply didn't have the organization on the ground, the organizational wherewithal to be competitive. And I think especially these three candidates made a rational decision to put their resources where they thought they might do more good.
Is the candidate that we have yet to mention here, the Reverend Al Sharpton, is he akin to Carol Moseley Braun, who almost went in saying Patricia Ireland, her campaign director, before she dropped out, was already saying, we know she doesn't have a snowball's chance of winning this thing, but we're behind her anyway. Is that a similar situation with the Reverend Al Sharpton?
Yeah, exactly, Todd. There's a sense with Al Sharpton, and by the way, I had a couple of very good students do some in-depth analysis of him last spring in a course on the presidency. He's really there as kind of a gadfly, as he would say, kind of a moral conscience for the nation to focus greater attention upon issues for African Americans and minorities, destitute or more disenfranchised types of constituents and populations. So, yeah, same thing with Carol Moseley Braun. Al Sharpton will certainly not win the nomination and will get very few delegates, but certainly will, he hopes, bring issues to the fore that perhaps the other candidates will not, and give us at least a different perspective on things.
Let's work our way towards John Kerry, if we could, beginning with Wesley Clark. He, along with Dean, has kind of the oddball factor going for him to a certain degree. What do you think his chances are in New Hampshire and beyond?
Yeah, Clark is very interesting. His late entry into the field, his, of course, very decorated military past, his close connections with former President Clinton, and also a persona or a speaking disposition that isn't as perhaps captivating as others, but seems to me is more down-home and kind of folksy. I still think Clark is more of an alternative candidate for the party if one of the others does not pan out. I think there's an expectation in some circles that with Gephardt out of the race now, and as you said, the word winnowing, things starting to winnow a bit, that Kerry would do very well in New Hampshire. It's kind of in his backyard with Massachusetts. But Clark has shown some power, some influence in that area. And he has, it's interesting, kind of the back and forth between Kerry and Clark about who has the better military credentials, essentially, to challenge Bush. And that's going to be something that will be very important to voters, not only in the Democratic side, but in the general election. And Clark and Kerry have essentially said, well, I have the background, the qualifications, the military temperament to at least challenge George W. Bush in the fall. So again, Clark, we'll see. He certainly looks decent in the polls, at least right now in New Hampshire. We'll have to see how the vote splits perhaps between Clark and Kerry.
Is Clark in any sense, he's denied he is, and other times also offered an olive branch to Dean, if I remember correctly. Is he running for running mate?
He certainly might be running for running mate. He's been one that certainly we've looked at in that light. Others have mentioned Edwards as well, because, as I alluded to, Edwards has run a fairly clean campaign and hasn't used some of the stronger in-party language that others have. So, yeah, certainly Clark could be in that vein. And if he were to be a running mate, certainly that four-star experience and his military background would reflect well within the Democratic Party and on the ticket.
John Kerry won Iowa handily. He's being projected, at least, of course, these things always do change, to carry, forgive the pun, New Hampshire pretty easily. And the big question that everyone's been talking about is electability, not so much electability as whether or not he is capable of beating George W. Bush. Is that the highest priority as the Democrats work their way toward a single candidate in the primary season?
Different perspectives on that, Todd. Some of the hardcores in the party, and not to characterize them as this, but especially some of the Dean folks, don't care as much about winning in the fall, but they care about the Democratic Party, in some ways, they would say, reestablishing their roots, focusing on issues of the working class, environmental issues, corporate malfeasance, cleaning up corporations. So those folks might say, well, we're kind of battling for the heart of the Democratic Party. Clinton, arguably, they would say, was too much a moderate or a centrist. Al Gore was in the same vein. And we really need to reestablish what the party stands for, even if it means we're going to lose in the fall. However, that sentiment seems to be being trumped by the, I guess, more pragmatists or pragmatics within the group who would say, well, it's more important to win in the fall, even if we have to moderate some of our positions, even if we can't be as true blue Democratic as we'd like to be. And a lot of these folks are saying we need someone with that military credential or with those experiences. And that's why a Clark or a Kerry certainly looks viable or at least looks competitive against Bush come fall.
To your mind, what does the present slate of candidates and the way it's shaking out in the primary season here at the beginning, what does it say about the soul or the center of the Democratic Party? What kind of a party are we looking at?
I think we're looking at a party that recognizes that we have a country, as we saw in 2000, as we've seen in the past 2002 elections, that is very polarized. When we look at, I just saw some data on party ID, and I'm a little off on the numbers, but it was something like 45% Democratic, 44% Republican, or maybe it was reversed, but among the country, that is, in some kind of party ID. So we're a very evenly divided country, where we have a right-wing or a conservative segment, and we see this in the Congress as well, that is very conservative on some issues, and then we have a left or a more liberal-leaning element in the country as well. And that's why those moderate voters, or the voters in the middle, you know, the smaller segment now that could go either way, really are so important because they can mean victory or defeat for a party. So I think the Democrats are saying that, you know, we probably can still maintain or retain our base. We don't see at this point Ralph Nader running. He's not going to run as a Green Party candidate. He said he could. He might run as an independent, but I don't see him replicating his success of 2000. So there really isn't a threat to come from the far left and to kind of co-opt that group. So it seems to me what this says about the Democratic Party is let's try and move a little more to the middle. Let's try and be new Democratic like Clinton. Let's try and use his playbook to regain at least some of the mechanics or some of the apparatus of power so that we can hopefully, they would say, pass some of their legislation.
What about when we finally get to November? Do you expect another red-blue split like we had in that famous map that we all saw between Republican and Democrat, a big stripe of red down the middle and the blue states out on the periphery, but a country, well, geographically and politically divided?
Yeah, Todd, exactly. We've seen some of the same trends in this division within the country. What's interesting, too, is a couple of other factors that are causing that division or that split to slightly change or alter. One is that in the reapportionment after the last census, where we reapportion the number of seats, the U.S. House seats for states based on population, if the election were held today, or even when it's held in a few months, the Republicans going in have even more of a built-in advantage at the presidential level because the states that tended to gain population the most in the 2000 census were states that Bush won in 2000. So essentially going into the fall, there's already a bit of a built-in advantage there for Bush, even given the very divided country. At the same time, we're seeing, of course, more and more growth in minority numbers. And although those are tending to go Democratic. There's a sense that Bush is trying to reach out and capture some of the Hispanic voter or a greater portion of that Hispanic vote. So I guess in sum, yes, it's a very evenly divided country with reapportionment, with growing numbers of certain minority groups. That just throws a couple new elements into the whole mix.
The primary season starts slowly over a course of about a month and then really hits its stride. And we get, as I said, in about 2 weeks, 8 states holding primaries. When can we expect, according to the way these things have gone in the past, for a definite front runner, a Democratic candidate in advance of their convention to actually emerge?
Good question, Todd. I guess we in Wisconsin would love it to be February 17, as that's our primary. Based on how things are shaping out now, we could have someone emerge already in a couple of weeks, although I kind of doubt that. The next major day would be, I believe it's March 3rd or 4th, where we're having a number of very populous states going. I believe California, New York, and a few others, Ohio perhaps. So it seems to me early March, when you have that very delegate-rich contest day, we could see something break by then. But again, we've seen already, and we've only had one caucus, but we've seen already surprising shows of strength by different candidates, which makes this a very unpredictable and turbulent primaries and caucus season.
Let's talk about Kerry, Edwards, and Dean in rapid fashion, if you would. Their major strength, their major weakness going up against George W. Bush, beginning with Kerry.
Yeah, Kerry, he exudes a certain presidential leadership, a certain persona. He's got the military, he's got the Vietnam experience. His weakness, seems to me, would be that he likes to have it both ways. He supported the war against Iraq, but now he's been very critical of how it's been managed and how it's been operated. So his weakness would be he likes to split hairs and likes to, it seems to me, at least have it both ways in a sense.
Number two in Iowa, Edwards, his major strength and weakness?
Yeah, Edwards, man of the people, photogenic, younger. He's got tremendous exuberance. Just looking at the poll data, however, a negative would be he doesn't have that kind of military prowess and he doesn't have the experience that perhaps would come with age that some of the others have.
And Dean, major strength, major weakness going into New Hampshire, had been hoped to be the front runner in Iowa.
Yeah, tremendous energetic candidate, gotten especially young people very involved in the process. People like his frankness. He's a smart guy. He's very good. He has been very good as an underdog, which he is again now. Weaknesses would be exemplified as we started by his Monday night concession speech, kind of a wild card, shoots from the hip, and for those reasons, people wonder about his temperament to be a president.
Missouri's primary is coming up here in a couple of weeks, and Gephardt, when he dropped out after Iowa, failed to endorse any of his fellow Democrats. He may still do that. How important is that? Missouri's no small pittance when it comes to delegates.
I think it would be very important. Gephardt, from afar, seems very respected in Missouri. And if Gephardt were to provide any direction or leadership to voters and do so in a way that, you know, would be diplomatic and clearly would be respectful of the voters, I think that would carry tremendous weight. The question is whom he might support, and that I really don't know that. Probably not Dean, just because they've been somewhat at each other's throat. Clark, perhaps. Probably not Lieberman. That's a tough one to call. You may know better, given you're right there.
What major issue, whoever emerges from the primary in the Democratic side, what will be the issue of the presidential campaign going into November in 2004?
Even though we're still, of course, wrapped up in security concerns and concerns in Afghanistan and in Iraq, the economy, I think, will be number one. Not only the overall health of the economy, but also what the candidates might say about the Bush tax cuts, about whether they should be rolled back, whether they should be made permanent. So the economy, you know, matters to people. It matters to people not only how generally the community is doing, but also their own pocketbook. And interesting, what we've tended to see in our studies is women, there's a bit of a gender gap here where women look more at how the economy is doing overall, whereas men tend to look more close to home or more at their own pocketbooks. So the economy, healthcare I thought would be a major issue, but perhaps that'll wait for 08, given, of course, the escalating costs.
And can we expect to see President George W. Bush doing some active and obvious campaigning now that the State of the Union address is behind him?
Yeah, I think he'll wade. You know, he'll wade in carefully. He did, of course, cleverly do some campaigning naturally within his State of the Union address, talking about his management of the war and of national defense, which seemed to be a bit of a challenge to Dean. Talked a little bit about his economic record and about the tax cuts and about how there's a correlation between the tax cuts and the economy, which is a little jab at some of the other Democrats. So somewhat in a backdoor way, Bush has started already with that political campaign, although I think he will try and stay take the high ground for a little while now and until he sees and until his team sees who might emerge to challenge him.
We started with that soundbite from Dean's concession speech on Monday in which he went a bit over the top. If he emerges and becomes the candidate for the Democrats, what's he going to have to change before he faces George W. Bush in a public and televised debate? One minute before we go.
Yeah, as much as I hate to say this, because I like the extemporaneous kind of off-the-cuff forthrightness and candor, I think Dean will need to be programmed, is a strong word, but just a little more deliberative and a little more thoughtful and precise in what he says, and perhaps take a breath. Do a little more precision in his preparation and just be a little more polished and focused and exude a demeanor that's more calm and a presence that's more reassuring.
Before we let you go, how is your Christmas, your first Christmas with the newborn?
Oh, very excellent. We're loving him. Matthew is about 6 weeks old now, and he's quite a blessing.
Matthew Henry, right?
Yes, very
All
good.
Right. Dr. Jeff Waltz, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Dr. Jeff Waltz, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. By the way, I think mid-February, we're going to be up there at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, along with Pastor Tom Baker. He'll be doing some speaking up there. I think we'll be broadcasting a show or two from there. Hopefully get a chance to meet Dr. Waltz in the flesh. Tomorrow on the program, what does it mean to be human? Is this distinction between human and person a valid one? Dr. Frank Beckwith of Baylor University will be our guest tomorrow to talk about that. Also, Dr. James Kaltoff, president of the Missouri District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, joins us tomorrow on the program to talk about Jesus only in our preaching, our teaching, and our service. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. We got to keep watching this primary season. You know, for me, it's entertainment. It's sport. It is serious, though, folks, and it gets more serious with every passing day. That's why we'll keep up the good work here at Issues Etc., and you keep listening. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.